So our final speaker today is the cognitive neuroscientist Tali Sherratt. Tali is the director of the Effective Brain Lab at University College London, where she and her team take a cross-disciplinary approach to researching the connection between human emotion, behavior, and brain function. So these are things that we've actually just been touching on through all of these different talks, and it's very convenient that her work is going to draw some of these themes together. Tali is a TED speaker. You can find her videos online. And she's also the author of two books. One is called The Optimism Bias, and her latest book is called The Influential Mind, and you'll be receiving a copy of that after. I'm a great admirer of Tali's work, and I couldn't be more pleased to welcome her to the Behavioral Alpha stage. Tali.
Thank you so much, Claire. So I got the kind of last 10, 15 minutes of the last session, so it seems like it's very relevant, so you should be all primed for this next talk. So I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, which basically is a mix of neuroscience and psychology, and my research also mixes behavioral economics as well. So I bring people into my lab, and I try to understand the brain mechanisms that give rise to how people act every day, how they interact, how they make decisions. And so today I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we've learned that's relevant to how people make financial decisions. So usually when you think about financial markets or about your investments, you usually think about something like this. But behind every dot and every line, there's in fact the decisions of many, many people. And to be more precise, the decisions taken by the headquarters of these individuals, which is a brain. And what's interesting about our brains is that they're much more similar than they are different. Our brains all have the same neural architecture, and they are working by the same basic rules. And so what this means is that if we know a little bit about our mind and our brain, we'll know a little bit about how people make decisions and be better able to predict them. But it doesn't end here, because here's you, and you have one of those as well. And so if we understand a little bit about how the mind works, we might be able to both make better decisions ourselves, but also be better able to communicate information and advice to others, whether it's our clients or our colleagues. So I'm going to start with a little experiment here in order to kind of start us off. So I'm going to give you three numbers. And what I want you to do is to try to figure out what rule I use to generate those numbers, okay? But don't tell me what it is, just keep it in your mind for now. So the numbers are 2, 4, 6. Okay, so now what we're gonna do is I'm gonna let you give me free numbers. I'll tell you if those numbers fit my rule or don't fit my rule, and then I will let you guess the rule, okay? So we're gonna start. I'm gonna pick you because you're in front of me. So you give me free numbers. I'll tell you if it fits my rule or not, and then I'll let you guess the rule.
13, 710, and 2000.
Yeah, you know the rule, don't you? You've seen this experiment before. Have you? Yes, you have. Okay, so we'll leave you to the third one. I'm gonna take two, and then I'm gonna come back to you. Okay, someone who hasn't heard it. Have you heard it before? Okay.
369,
it fits my rule. Do you want to guess a rule?
It's a random list of three numbers.
Random list, no. Good guess, though. Good guess. Okay, one more.
1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3, yes. Do you want to guess?
They're going up.
They're going up, true. So I guess you were going to say the same thing. Yeah, you're actually the best that I've ever had. I'm not kidding. So my rule is just escalating numbers. So I don't remember your exact numbers, but 2, 4, 2,000 would be correct, but 100, 0, 5 would be incorrect. But the point of this is to show you that based on a limited set of numbers, what we usually do is we come up with strong beliefs in our head. For example, you know, whether it's random numbers or plus two. And then what we do is we go out and we try to find evidence that would confirm to those beliefs. And rarely do we go out and try to find evidence that would challenge those beliefs. So this little demonstration was first shown by Peter Wason, who was a professor in my own department at UCL. And the point of this experiment is not really about numbers. It is to demonstrate the fact that we all have beliefs about a range of things, right? We have beliefs about ourselves and our family. We have belief about how things should work in our industry, in our company, about gender. And then we go out and try to find evidence that confirms it to make our beliefs stronger and more confident. But what happens when you do encounter a piece of information that doesn't quite fit to your hypothesis and predictions, or someone who disagrees with your hypothesis and predictions? So we wanted to know what happens, and we wanted to know what goes on inside the human brain when you encounter conflicting opinions or evidence. So we brought individuals into our labs in twos, and we asked them to make financial decisions together. Specifically, they had to assess real estate. And while they were doing that, we looked at their brain activity in two imaging scanners, but they could communicate over the Wi-Fi. So the way that it works is people come in, they lie down like that. There's a little head coil. The head coil has a mirror. And the mirror shows everything that we're projecting on a computer screen at the back. And so they can see, for example, the opinions of the other people, and then they can respond using the button boxes. And while they were doing that, we record their brain activity using a method called functional MRI. So what we found was that when two people agreed, each person's brain showed very specific encoding of the information coming from the agreeing partner. So what I'm showing you here is a slice of the brain. So if I were to cut your brain like this and look inside, and I'm highlighting all the areas that statistically we could show is encoding information coming from the agreeing partner. And what happened to people's confidence in their own belief? It became stronger. Makes sense. If you agree with me, I become more confident. But when two people disagreed, metaphorically speaking, it looked like the brain was shutting down, and it wasn't encoding the information that was coming from the disagreeing partner. And what happened to people's confidence when they learned that someone disagrees with them? It went down, but by a very small amount. It was almost non-significant. So this is an example of what's known as a confirmation bias, which is our tendency to take in information that confirms what we believe with open arms, but to be a bit skeptical about information and people who disagree with our opinions. So usually people want to know, well, is this true for everyone? Is there individual differences? Well, if you see yourself as highly analytical, which I assume all of us in the room do, embrace yourself. So a study conducted by Dan Kahan at Yale University found that people with better analytical and math skills are more likely to twist data at will. So what he did was he tested 1,000 Americans, and the first thing he did is he gave them a math test. And based on the math test, he divided them into those with really good math and analytical skills and those with not so good analytical skills. And then he gave them two sets of data. The first set of data, he said, is looking at whether skin treatment is helping a skin rash. Look at the data, analyze the data, and tell us whether the treatment is helpful. So unsurprisingly, those with better math skills did better at this task. Then he gave them another set of data. This set of data, he said, is looking at whether gun control is reducing crime. Look at the data, analyze the data, and tell me whether gun control is helpful. Now, the difference here, of course, is that everyone had strong opinions about gun control. Some people were for and some people were against. And those opinions interfered with their ability to analyze the data. And relatively speaking, those with better math and analytical skills actually did worse on this task. So it seems that people were using their skills not necessarily to find the truth, but to find fault with the data that they were unhappy with. So if you think about how that relates to financial decision making, if we already have a strong belief about a company, an investment, a stock, those beliefs could interfere with data that comes in later. And so we may interpret that data in light of the beliefs that we already have. We did a study that showed this, in which we brought people into our lab and we gave them 100 different negative events that can happen to them. For example, before that, the interesting question is, why have we evolved a brain that is happy to disregard perfectly good information when it doesn't confirm our beliefs, right? It doesn't sound something adaptive. Well, the truth is that the brain assesses a new piece of evidence in light of the beliefs that we already have, because on average, that is the correct thing to do. Let me give you an example. So let's say that I told you that I saw a pink elephant flying in the sky. You would assume that I am delusional or lying, as you should, because you have a strong belief based on your experience that elephants don't fly in the sky. And so in most cases, when a piece of evidence conflicts a strong belief that we have, on average, that piece of evidence is wrong. And it would be a really bad idea to go around the world and change our beliefs and our model of the world every time that a piece of evidence doesn't fit it, right? That would not allow us to work in the world in a way that's adaptive. But it also means that strongly held beliefs, when they are false, are very difficult to change. But there is one exception, though. And that is when the piece of evidence doesn't fit what you believe, but it fits what you want to believe. So let me give you an example. So a few months before the presidential election in the United States, a group here in the UK asked 1,000 Americans, who do you want to win? And who do you think is going to win? So back then, about half wanted Trump to win, and about half wanted Clinton to win. But back in August 2016, both the Trump supporters and the Clinton supporters believed that Clinton was going to win. And so then they gave them the poll, and a poll suggested that Trump was the one who's going to win. And then they asked them again, so who do you think is going to win? They wanted to see whether this poll will change the predictions of what is about to happen. And what they found was that the Trump supporters indeed changed their beliefs. They said, well, maybe Trump is going to win. But the Clinton supporters, not so much. They said, well, we don't really believe this poll. We still think she's probably going to win. Again, if we take this into the financial domain, if you already have invested in a specific stock or in a specific company, well, now you have a motivation, right? This is what you want to believe. You want to believe that this is a good decision. And that, again, will alter the way that you process incoming information. And so we did a study like this in the lab, where we brought people in and we gave them 100 different negative events that may happen to them, such as, for example, being a victim of card fraud. And we asked them, what do you think is the likelihood that you will be a victim of card fraud? And then we gave them information about the average likelihood of someone like them experiencing this event. So card fraud is about 70% in the population. And then we asked them again, what is the likelihood that you will be a victim of card fraud? What we wanted to see is whether people will take the information that we gave them to alter their beliefs. And indeed, they did. But again, mostly when the information was better than what they expected. So if someone started off saying, I believe that my likelihood of being a victim of card fraud, this has stopped working for some reason. Okay, so if someone said my, something here happened. Continue to the internet. Okay, right. So if someone said my likelihood of being a victim of card fraud is about 90%, and we said, hey, good news, it's actually about 70%, the next time around they said, okay, well, maybe it's about 75% or so. But if someone started off saying, I believe my likelihood of being a victim of card fraud is about 30%, and we said, hey, bad news, it's actually more like 70%, the next time around they said, well, you know, for me, I still think it's about 33%. So it's not that they didn't learn at all. They did learn, but they learned much less when the information was worse than expected than when it was better than expected. And also, it's not that they didn't remember the information that we gave them. We tested their memories. They remembered the information, but they didn't think it was relevant to them as much when it was bad news, but much more when it was good news. So again, we wanted to know what goes on inside the human brain that makes people more likely to disregard the negative information. So we conducted our experiment while recording brain activity. And what we found was that when people received good news, there were quite a few regions in the brain that were encoding that good news, including this region here that is called the left inferior frontal gyrus, so over here. And it didn't matter what type of person you were. You could be a highly optimistic person, slightly pessimistic, even slightly depressed. Everyone's brain was really good at encoding this positive, unexpected information. On the other side of the brain, the right inferior frontal gyrus was encoding negative information, and it wasn't doing as good of a job. And the more optimistic someone was, according to trait questionnaires, the less likely they were to encode this negative information. So we wondered whether we could change this by changing activity in people's brains. And there's a way for us to do that. So this is my collaborator. And what he's doing is he's passing a small magnetic pulse through the scalp of this participant, and we can direct it to a certain part of the brain, like the left inferior frontal gyrus, for example. And so when we do that, we interfere with that part of the brain for about half an hour. And everything, and after that, everything goes back to normal, or so we hope. But doing that half an hour, we can do our little experiment. And let me show you what we found. So first of all, so what I'm going to be plotting here is how much people learn more from the unexpected good news and the bad news. So first of all, if I were to test all of you here, this is the average amount that you would learn more from good and bad. Then we interfered with a part of the brain that was encoding bad news. We interfered with it. And so then the bias became even stronger, right? And when we interfered with a part of the brain that was encoding positive information, we interfered with it, the bias disappeared altogether. So we were quite amazed by that because we were able to eliminate a deep-rooted bias in humans. But of course, we're not going to go around zapping people's brains. And so what this means is that on average, when people see bad news and warnings such as this, they say, yes, smoking kills, but mostly it kills the other guy. But when they hear that the market is going up, they say, oh, my house will definitely rise in price. And it turns out that it's not only that we turn to take in the good news more than the bad, we also look out for the good news more than the bad. Let me give you an example from the stock market. So this is a study that was conducted by Carlson, Lowenstein, and Seppi, behavioral economists. And what they wanted to know is, when do people log into their accounts to check on their stocks? So what you're looking here in black is the S&P 500 over 2 years. And in gray is a number of times that people logged into their accounts just to have a peek without any intention of making a transaction. And the numbers here have been corrected for all the obvious confounds, like market volumes and willingness to transact. OK, so what do we see? When the market is going up, people are more likely to log in. They say the market has gone up, probably I gain money, and they want to get a little bit of a sniff of the good news. And when the market goes down, people are less likely to log in. They're avoiding the bad news. Now, all of this is true as long as bad news can reasonably be avoided. So what you don't see here is what happened a few months later in the financial collapse of 2008, when the market went drastically down, and that's when people started logging in frantically. We actually did a similar study in the lab. So when you do these, you know, take real-world data, it's a little bit hard to interpret because there's a lot of different factors and you can't control for everything. But one advantage of doing these things in the lab is that we have full control over all the elements. So we created a stock market in our lab, which we controlled, and we brought people in and we gave them an endowment. And we told them they could use endowment to buy some stocks, and they did in our market. And then on every trial, we showed them what's happening with the market, and we asked them, do you want to know what's happening with your stocks? They couldn't sell or buy, so there's nothing they can do. It's just, do you want to know at this moment? But there was a little trick. If they wanted to know, they had to pay us for that information. And if they didn't want to know, they also had to pay us so we won't show them the information. If they didn't pay us, it was random whether we show information or not. And what we found was that when market was going up, they were more likely to pay us to see how much they're worth. And when the market was going down, they were more likely to pay us to avoid that information. Now, they only paid us, you know, 6p, 10p, it wasn't a lot. But still, that was a finding. What this can cause is because we're more likely to seek the good news and we're more likely to interpret it than the bad, to take it into our beliefs, that can create overconfidence, right? Because then we say, well, you know, my predictions are correct. It can be overconfidence in our decisions, but also in our abilities as well. And that can cause, for example, to overtrade. And let me give you an example of this, kind of a very basic example. Again, we're going to have a little experiment here. So this time, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a list of abilities and characteristics. And for each of these abilities, I'm going to ask you where you think you stand relative to the rest of the population. So the first ability is getting along well with others. Who here believes they're at the bottom 50% of getting along well with others? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. That's actually even more than usual, 5, 6. Okay, top 50%? Okay, that's most of us here. Okay. Now, do the same for your driving ability. How interesting are you? How attractive are you? How honest are you? And finally, how modest are you? So most people put themselves above average on most of these characteristics. They're even willing to bet money on it if you ask them to. Now, we can't all be better than the average Joe, but if we think we're slightly more interesting, slightly more social, then we think, well, we're more likely to succeed, right? We're more likely to make the right decision. And that can explain a lot of phenomena that you see in the world. So for example, out of every 3 small businesses in the US, only 1 remains standing after 5 years. That's 33%. But when you ask small business owners, 81% say that it is them that will remain standing, right? So people tend to be overconfident. Another example is people in the US, out of every 4 people, 3 say that they believe AI is going to destroy more positions that it will create. That's 75%. But only 1 out of every 4, that's 25%, believe it is their position that is going to be terminated. So these are examples that then lead to what we call the optimism bias. So the optimism bias is the tendency of people to overestimate the likelihood of positive events in the future and underestimate the likelihood of negative events in the future, such as losing your job, accidents, and so on. And again, to kind of demonstrate this, I want you to think about your future. Think about yourself 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Try to think about your family, your relationships, your career. Really kind of try to have vivid images in your mind. So who here comes up with positive images? Put your hand up. Okay, so this is quite common. When you ask people to imagine the future, the first thing we do is we come up with these kind of sunny, positive images. And in fact, people tend to believe that the future will be better than the present time. And that can cause misestimations of things that might happen. So for example, if you're currently married, what is the likelihood you think that you will be divorced? 0%, 10%, 50%, 90%? So don't tell us, keep it in your mind. But when you ask newlyweds, for example, they say that the likelihood of divorce is 0%, when the average likelihood in the Western world is 40%. So that can create mispredictions. That little message is up again. Okay, sorry. But interestingly, the optimism bias goes away when people are stressed. When people are stressed, within a few minutes, the way that you process information changes. You become hypervigilant to negative information, and then people actually lose their optimism bias and even can become overly pessimistic. So we did a study to show this in the lab where we brought students in and we wanted to stress them out. So in order to stress them out, we gave them a topic and we told them, you're going to have to give a 5-minute talk about this topic immediately. And we're all going to judge you and rate you and we're going to videotape you and we're going to put it on YouTube. And the students got quite stressed, but we wanted to make sure that they're stressed. So we took saliva samples, we checked their cortisol, we looked at their skin conductance, so when they're stressed, people sweat. We also asked them if they're stressed. They said, yes, we're stressed. So they were stressed. And then we gave them the study that I told you about before, where we give people information that either is better or worse than expected, like being a victim of card fraud and so on. And what we found was that when people were stressed, they started taking in the negative information, and there wasn't a bias anymore in how they took positive and negative information. We did the same with firefighters in the state of Colorado. So firefighters sometimes have very stressful days, right? There's a lot of life-threatening events, and sometimes it's quite calm. They're in the station. And again, we found that when they were stressed, In our study, they started taking in the negative information, no bias, but they were, when they were calm, there was a bias. So if you think about what this means in response to stressful public events such as market collapse, terrorist attacks, natural disasters, when a stressful event happens, for example, a terrorist attack, even if the terrorist attack is halfway across the world, people get quite stressed. And that changes the way that the brain processes information, making people hypervigilant to negative information, of which at that time there's going to be a lot. They take that negative information, more likely to take it in, and become overly pessimistic. And that can cause suboptimal decisions. So for example, when after market collapse, people are more likely to sell when really what they need is to hold on. After a terrorist attack, people will cancel their flight and get into the car, although driving is more dangerous. And this can relate to the ups and downs that we see in the market, the overreactions. So in common times, what we see when things are relatively calm, we often see an overreaction in the positive direction, what can cause sometimes bubbles in the market, right? So the optimism bias, when you tend to overestimate the likelihood of positive events, can cause this overreaction in a positive way. But then the market starts going down and people start getting stressed and start being hypervigilant to negative, and that can then cause overreaction in the negative direction, so overly pessimistic. And interestingly, this all relates to how old you are. So it turns out that stress changes in quite a systematic way throughout your lifespan. So stress starts quite low, goes up, 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 reaches your peak in your midlife, and then goes down. Happiness goes the other way. So happiness tends to go from early on, it goes down, 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 reaches rock bottom in your midlife, but then the good news is that it actually goes up again. You know, this could be you, or this could be the person that you are interacting with. And so given all of this, given that we know that we have a confirmation bias and an optimism bias and overconfidence, and stress changes the way that you process information, what can we do about all of this? So the first thing is, if we know our bias, we can plan ahead. So we can have a policy in place to try to protect us from our biases. And I heard you speaking a little bit about that, so let me give you a few examples of how I think this relates. So first of all, if we have a policy on how to make decisions, then these things such as stress would not necessarily change our decisions in a systematic way, right? Because we have the policy on how to make decisions. Interestingly, when you talk to people who do investments and also traders, they often use models now, right? That's what they do, they use models. But still, interestingly, they have to choose, turns out that they choose every other day or every week what model to choose, right? What model to use. So they're still making decisions, although they have a model that tells them what choices to make. They have this biases that, oh, this model is the one that I should go with today, or this model performed really well recently. So you still need a policy of how to make any kind of decision. Now, let me give you an example from the British government. So the British government has a book that's known as a Green Book, which is a book with recommendations for project assessors. And in that Green Book, they say that there is an optimism bias that causes people to underestimate budgets and underestimate how long projects should take. And therefore, all the projects in the British government have to be corrected for the optimism bias. And they did this for the 2012 Olympic budget, which was relatively on budget relative to other Olympics. Now, they have actually a very long PDF to explain how they did it, but the principle is quite simple, which is they looked at other projects which are similar, other Olympics, see what the budget was for those ones, and then saw what the actual budget was, so what the predicted budget was, what the actual budget was, calculated the average bias, and then added that to their own budget. So this is one example that if you know your bias, you can figure out what are the potential negative outcomes of this bias, and then put in the policy in place to correct yourself. Now, what the British government did, which was quite right, is that they didn't say change your bias. They didn't say change your predictions. And we know that's impossible, right? Because these biases have evolved over millions of years. But we can change our decisions by putting in a policy in place. Now, the second advice is something that not everyone necessarily has the tools to take on at the moment, but I'll tell you what it is because those tools may be developed. So the thing with financial decisions, especially investments for the long term, is that they don't occur that often, and you don't have immediate feedback. So you're making a decision now, but you don't know if the decision was a good one or bad one until months or years later. And so when you don't have immediate feedback, it's very difficult to learn. It's very difficult to correct wrong decisions. Most things that you learn, you have immediate feedback. So let's say you're learning a new language, German, and you make a mistake, and so someone tells you straight away, oh, you didn't say that right, and then you correct yourself. Or you're learning how to play tennis. You made a mistake, or you made a good decision or good action, and so you immediately see the feedback, and so you can correct your actions, right? With financial decision-making, that's very difficult because they're usually for the long term. And so one thing that you could do is you could use simulations in order to become better. So for example, use past data from 5 years ago, 10 years ago that you don't necessarily are not familiar with. Use that data to make decisions and see immediately whether those were good or bad decisions, and then you can correct yourself. You can say, oh, look, I was overconfident here, right? And you're not even going to do this by being aware. If you make a decision and you get feedback, you immediately learn. And so that's a way to become better. Third, given that we know that people are overconfident, we really need to remember to assess competence and not confidence, because confidence is not necessarily the best indicator of competence. Now, we kind of know that this is true. Most people are aware of that. But yet, we don't tend to act on it, because it's very easy to just take confidence, right, as a measure. We have this heuristic to go with confidence, but we really need to kind of make sure that when someone comes and they're very confident, we need to ask the questions to figure out whether there is competence there as well. And the last point, which is what I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk, is that if we know how the brains around us work, well, that means we'll be much better able to communicate information and advice to others, right? If you know that people tend to have a confirmation bias, an optimism bias, well, that means you can change the way that you communicate with others. And so now I'm going to tell you a few ways that we could do that. So the first thing is, in the beginning of the talk, I told you that the brain does a really good job at taking in any information that's coming from an agreeing partner, right? But tends to not take in information coming from a disagreeing partner as well. And so that means is that when you're trying to convince someone with a different opinion, the worst thing you can do is say, oh, you're wrong and I'm right, and here's all the data why I'm right and you're wrong, because the person in front of you will either shut down, not listen, or they will start thinking about actually why they are right and what you're saying is wrong, right? And so what we need to do is we always need to start by addressing common grounds. What beliefs do we have in common? What motivations we have in common? Because once the other side sees us as an agreeing partner, then they're more likely to take in the information. I'm going to give you an example of this from the health domain, not the financial domain, because this example is especially good. So this example relates to the problem of vaccines. So there are many parents but there's a certain amount of parents that decide they don't want to vaccinate their kids because of the alleged link to autism. And so normally when they would go to the physician and express this opinion, the physician will say, well, here's all the data and all the studies showing that there isn't a link. And studies have shown that this is not very effective, because the parent already has, you know, a strong opinion, and this data is not going to change it. And so then a group at UCLA said, well, can we take another route? Can we get to the action that we want, which is getting parents to vaccinate their kids, without focusing on what we disagree on? Can we, in fact, focus on what we agree on? And so what they did is, instead of focusing on the link to autism, they highlighted that these vaccines are effective at protecting kids from potentially deadly diseases, the mumps, rubella, and measles. Now, this is not something that the parents disagreed with. They agreed with that, but it seemed to have been forgotten in the heat of the debate. And so by concentrating on what they agreed on, they were 3 times more likely to change the parents' intentions to vaccinate their kids. So that is looking for common ground in order to change action and opinions. Now, the second thing I told you is that the brain does a much better job at taking information that suggests the future is better than what we expected than information suggesting it's worse. And so what that means is that we need to reframe our message to highlight the progress rather than decline. So for example, instead of saying, if you take route A, you will lose time and money, you might say, if you take route B, you will gain time and money. Or another example from another domain, if instead of telling a teenage kid, if you smoke, you get cancer, you might say, if you don't smoke, you're more likely to get on the basketball team. So this doesn't mean sugarcoating anything, right? And if someone did a bad job, you don't say, oh, it wasn't too bad. That's not the idea. The idea is to say exactly, you know, what the truth is. But instead of saying, this is so bad, we're going to lose all this money, you say, well, now we need to do ABC, or in the future, you need to do ABC in order to get the gains that we want. And a related point is that everything that I told you about just now was about the future, right? You say, you know, don't smoke now, and you're more likely to get on the basketball team in the future. Or you do this, in the future you get more money, right? Invest now, you get more money in the future. And that's great, but humans are very much incentivized by rewards that they can get now, right? We all know about present bias and temporal discounting. Rewards that we can get now are more likely to motivate us on average than rewards that we can get in the future. And that's, again, a problem, because often we're trying to get people to do an action now for something that's good for them in the future. And so what we need to do is we need to try to build a bridge across this temporal gap. Is the action that we are recommending now, can it also give them immediate rewards? Not only rewards in the future, what can it do now? Maybe it's monetary rewards, but maybe it's more of psychological reward. Maybe it's a sense of safety. Maybe it's some kind of social feedback. People go out of their ways to get those little likes on Facebook, right? They really do extraordinary stuff just to get those likes. They're very effective, these immediate but very small rewards. And interestingly, if you want people to act, rewards are more effective than scaring people about punishments that can happen in the future. And this is because of something known as the approach avoidance principle. So let me explain to you what that is. So to get the good stuff in life, whether it is chocolate cake or promotion or love, we often need to act. Right? We need to do something. If I'm thirsty and I want a drink, I need to move my hand and get the water. So our brain has evolved in this kind of environment where action is related to reward. And so when we expect a reward, a go signal is activated from deep in our brain, in the midbrain, and it goes up to the reward center in our brain and to our frontal cortex and our motor cortex, and it makes action more likely. On the other hand, in order to avoid the bad stuff in life, whether it is poison or untrustworthy people or deep waters, we often have to not act, not do anything. Okay? Not always, but often to avoid the bad stuff, we need not to act. And so our brain has evolved in that kind of environment, and when we expect something bad, a no-go signal is triggered from the midbrain, goes up to our motor cortex, and it inhibits action. And so what that means is that if we want people to act, highlighting the rewards is a better way. But if you want people not to act, for example, you want them not to share privileged information, highlighting possible bad outcomes, punishments, may actually be better. So we did a study where we had people have to press a button in order to get a dollar, and they did really well. And then we also had another condition where they had to press a button in order to avoid losing a dollar. And they were much slower at pressing the button in order to avoid losing the dollar than pressing the button in order to gain a dollar, right? Because when action is related to reward, people are quicker, and they're actually more accurate as well. And the fourth principle is expanding people's agency. So one of the major things that the brain is trying to do at all times, it's trying to control its environment in order to gain reward and avoid harm. And so anytime that people feel they have agency, they're in control, they have a choice, they're more motivated. But when they feel agency is restricted, they become anxious. This is one reason that people are really anxious on planes. It's not only because they fear disaster, but also on a plane we have no control. We're not controlling where the plane going, we're not even controlling what we're eating, and that causes people to be anxious. And so one way to get people committed and motivated is to give them a choice. So for example, imagine that you could choose between two projects. One project will take you, one project will make you stay in London, and the other project will take you to New York. And they're both great, and you don't know what to choose, and you say, okay, I'm gonna choose New York. What we find is that seconds after making the decision, people are more likely to say, ooh, a good thing that I chose New York. You know, London wouldn't be so great to stay here. In New York, I get to see great theater and do new things. And so they reevaluate the options immediately after making the choice. So a few seconds after making the choice, they look at the options differently than a few seconds before. So the act of making the choice changed their own preferences. You can see this on social media all the time. Let's say you kind of click like or retweet or whatever. You're clicking it because you like or agree with what the person said. But by acting, by pressing like, pressing retweet, you're now more committed to that statement. And now you believe in it even more because actions will change our preferences. And so what that means is that you want to give people choices. You can direct them to the choice that you think, but at least have them a sense that they are involved in the choice. Now, you don't want to give people too many choice. I don't know if you've heard about the famous jam experiment where people got an option to choose between 60 different jams, and some were so overwhelmed that just left the store with no jam at all. So too many options are not good, but two or three options tend to be the optimal amount. Okay, and finally, this is the last thing, personalizing. So everything that I said now would perhaps work in most cases, in many contexts, for many individuals, but psychology is not like physics. It is much more complex. We don't have one rule like gravity that is always right, right? It is important to consider who is a person in front of you, what is their mental state. I already told you that stress will change completely how the brain operates. And so we need to consider that when communicating information and advice to others. So we need to consider state, but we also need to consider trait. So for example, is this person more risk averse or more risk seeking? Is there more loss averse? What about their temporal discounting? Do they prefer the present much more or the future much more? Interestingly, you know, in psychology and behavioral economics, we actually have tasks that can measure these things quite quickly. Within doing a task of a few minutes, we can actually measure things like risk aversion, loss aversion, and say what preferences a certain individual has. So it might be helpful to know what your own preferences are, but also those of the person in front of you when advising someone on their financial decisions. The things that I mentioned were to start with common ground, highlight the opportunity for progress rather than decline. Think about either immediate rewards, not only future rewards, expanding agency by giving people a choice, and considering who the specific person in front of us is. And this is really the last thing that I'm going to say, which is many times, we're not aware of how our brain works. This is something that we need to study and find out. We are not born with an understanding that a choice changes preferences. But once we become aware of all of these things, we will be better able to make decisions ourselves, but perhaps also help others make decisions. But often people ask me, well, now that I know all of this, will it mean that I won't have a bias anymore? So will I not be overconfident because I know it exists? Well, it doesn't really work like that. And to kind of convince you that it doesn't, I'm going to close by showing you an example from the visual domain. And I'm sure all of you have seen many visual illusions, but this is one of my favorite that is not as known. So look at this and tell me what you see. So it looks like an upside down photo of a smiling girl. So when you look at this upright, it's quite clear that something is wrong, right? When you look at it upside down, it's not very salient. So this is actually known as the Thatcher illusion, because it was first shown on Margaret Thatcher, because she wasn't quite known for her smiles. And the way that you could do it yourself at home is you cut out the mouth and you cut out the eyes, you rotate them and paste them back. Now, why does this illusion work? It works because we are very good at perceiving upright faces. We do it all the time, right? I see 100 of you upright faces in front of me. I'm very good at making these perceptions. We don't often see upside down faces. And so our brain has not been tuned to see the little, you know, odd things about upside down faces. Now, the important thing about this demonstration is that although you've seen the illusion unfold and you understand it, the illusion has not gone away, right? Maybe a little tiny bit, maybe, but not fully. And the same thing is true for cognitive biases. Knowing about them can help the illusion a little bit, but it's not going to go away. But what it would do is help you make better decisions because you know the illusions are there, so you can take actions to protect yourself. Okay, so I'm just going to end with that and go to questions. Yeah?
There's so much in that that resonates for me, but one of the main things is about how the active fund management industry has been in a bad situation for quite a long time, and yet very little has changed. And when you talk about fear not being an effective method for encouraging behavioral change, you know, I think, yeah, that people have been going on at fund managers about how it's, you know, you can't make money, you can't generate alpha, it's over, you're bad, the assets are going, it's, you know, it's all down. And the industry is just sort of stuck with the status quo and not changed very much about what it does. When, what if the message to everybody had been, look at these opportunities, look at these gains that you could be making? I mean, that's obviously the message that we try to put across at Essentia, but, you know, a lot of people could be putting that message across. I wonder if we would have seen more action out of this industry if that positive message and that you know, potential for improvement was what we stressed.
Yeah, no, fear causes us to freeze, right? So when something happens, like a car is coming in front of you, the first thing you do is freeze for a second or a split second, and then you run away. But the intuition is, when something is frightening, the first thing you do is freeze, and then you can fight or flight.
So I'm sure some of you have some questions for Tali.
You said that under stress condition, people tend to remove the optimist bias, but is it possible to know how much stress removes the optimist bias without involving the pessimist bias?
Yeah, so in fact, in our studies, and the way that it removes it, just to remind you, is because of the way you process information. So you have to have information coming in, so it doesn't just change your predictions without information. In our studies, it just removed it. So it didn't cause a pessimism bias. So at least you can say, for this kind of daily stresses, like, oh, I need to give a talk and I've never done it before and people are going to judge me, that's quite stressful. But it's not, you know, life-threatening. Although I guess the firefighters are life-threatening, but they're, again, it's their job, so you shouldn't. So in that level, it just becomes equal. But we do know that people with severe depression tend to have a pessimistic bias. So they believe that the future will be worse than what it actually is, and they take in the negative more than the positive. We know that depression is often triggered by a stressful life event, a traumatic event. So I think in those extreme cases, it can switch it. So we don't really know, and it matters, again, who the person is and how susceptible he is or she is. But it could be that things like, you know, big things like terrorist attacks, like the real big things, could cause a switch.
This is fascinating. I'm curious, the notion of choice and how that sort of changes your assessment of your options is really interesting, especially in light of like buyer's remorse, where your choice actually leads you to think like, oh my God, what did I do? Can you talk about the relationship between
Those two concepts? So this works mostly when you cannot change. So there's a difference between buyer's remorse. Buyer's remorse, you could find it mostly when you can actually return your product. But the choice, when choice affects preference in the way that I said, is mostly when you can't go back. So you voted already. So you already voted for the candidate. So you can't go back, and that really changes the way that you preference. Or you bought something, and you can't go back. So there's been studies that actually check that exact thing. Daniel Gilbert at Harvard University did a study where he had people choose between like different art, and in one condition they could give it back, and the other they couldn't, and it's when you can't that it really is a strong effect. But when you can, then people tend to think about, okay, well, I can have another choice. I can make another choice, right?
So we know that there are differences in confidence between genders. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in the response to stress?
Top of my head, not something that would be very strong that I could say. My tendency is to say no. We didn't necessarily see it in our own studies, but we don't, in order to see gender differences, you really need a large number of both genders. You need to control for everything else. It's not something that is extremely, that I've seen in the literature, which suggests to me that if it exists, it's not strong. Yeah.
Hi there. Just to get back to one of your points on policy earlier, and presumably around formulating checklists and methodologies in terms of decision making. Look, I get how that can de-bias to a degree, I guess, decisions. But even within those questions that one has to ask oneself, if I think about the investment industry specifically, clearly there's scope for bias, even by forcing people to more thoroughly think through their decisions. And I kind of wonder, in your experience, what's the best overarching debiasing technique? Is it sort of like pre-mortem analysis and forcing oneself to think of, a potential result that is at the other end of the spectrum to what is expected? Mm-hmm. Have you any particular, I suppose, comments to make around?
Yeah. So first, just when we say debias, I don't think you could de-bias your thoughts and predictions, you could just correct for them in outcomes. So I'm not going to de-bias my overconfidence or my optimism bias or confirmation bias, but given that I know that I have it, I could do things. Now, the thinking won't happen at the moment. The idea is, it's not, I need to make a decision now, and now I'm going to think through my biases. It's more along the lines of putting in the structure. So for example, let's take science, my field, as an example. I have a theory, and so I'm very motivated to find evidence for my theory in my data. And so this is what scientists do, and I'm sure I do this like everyone else. And in order to make sure that science is as accurate as possible, the procedure is I would write a paper, and then I would send it with the data to people who don't have the same theory, either no theory at all, but maybe even the other way, right? And they would comment on, if they think it supports the conclusion or doesn't. And I do that myself, even before sending it to a journal. A journal will then do it officially as well. So there's all of these procedures in place because we know that a confirmation bias will cause us to take the data and make it fit to our theory rather than the other way around. So that's kind of the way of thinking. So it's more about the structure that needs to change because of what you know. And it doesn't mean that I don't have a confirmation bias. See, my confirmation bias is stale, but I am going to have to publish with a study that would, someone who doesn't have my theory would look at the data and say, yes, okay, that's true. Or if they don't, then I can have my thoughts, but what I'm publishing is going to be a bit less than what I really believe, in order to, so that's kind of the idea.
Thank you.
I was just thinking in terms of managing fund managers, there's the stuff you can do about thinking about it, and then there's the environment. You talked about stress, and there's also the cognitive load, how much information you've got coming in all the time. Obviously, the curve is related. If I was to ask you, so I'm managing these managers, and I've got these two parameters, these two environmental parameters that I can change. How should I change them so that the managers make better decisions, forgetting about all the other stuff, their own cognition of what's happening?
It will be very generic because there's not one answer to anything. As I said, it's not physics, and if I gave you an answer like that, it was incorrect. But in general, when it comes to stress, the studies show that in general, for most things, a bit of stress is a good thing. So you don't want pure relaxation, and you don't want extreme stress, because extreme stress will change the way that you know, your cognitive abilities, and will create what you said. It creates a sense of overload. So a certain amount of stress is good. So that's a kind of what's the reverse U shape that is known. I don't know if you've come across it. In terms of cognitive overload, I mean, overload is never good by saying it's overload. On the same, you know, you do want people to be engaged and interested in challenges. So I don't know if it's quite the same for decision making, but for decision making, you need to learn. And the best place to learn is not when things are easy, because there's nothing to learn, and not when they're too challenging. So you want to be in this place for each person that it is somewhat challenging, but not too much, in order to be able to learn. Now, that's for the learning, right? But you need that to keep people engaged and so on. And then, of course, you need to create a system that each person can find that kind of sweet spot. I don't know if that kind of answered. Okay.
Just to go back to optimism bias, we know that, so our news is, I think, negatively skewed, and presumably that's what the market wants. So does the negative skew to the news, is it emphasizing the optimism bias, or is it counteracting it? And why do you think we organize our news so that it's... it's negatively skewed.
So I didn't mention something very important, which is the optimism bias is true for predictions about yourself and anything that relates to your own outcomes, but not for the general public. So let me say two things. First thing is, we have what we call private optimism but public despair. So people have private optimism about themselves, but not about the person sitting next to them. They are not optimistic about their leaders or where the country is going in general and all of that. They could be optimistic about things like markets if they are invested in the market, right? So we don't have an optimism about public global issues at all. To the contrary, we often have a pessimism bias about that. There's one important reason, there's another reason, but one important reason is actually control. So we have an optimism bias about ourselves because we believe we have control over our life, so we can steer the wheel in the right direction. We don't feel we have control over these big public issues, and so we're not so optimistic about them. That's the kind of thing that you see a lot in the media, right? This kind of global pessimism, which people react to, you know, quite well, to say, quite responsive to. Yeah.
Does that help explain the fact of Freud?
I think it's related. The way that I think about that, and so this is the idea that if someone else fails, I feel good about that. And there's actually a lot of studies also in neuroscience showing that, right? The reward system is activated when I see someone else fail. I think it could be related to relativity, which again is related to what I said before, which is, well, if I do well, that's great, but everything is relative. So if I'm doing well and the two people next to me are doing, you know, not just neutral, they're actually below, then I'm even more above in relative value. So I think it's more about how I see my value rather than wanting other people to suffer.
And how an optimist view leads to better outcomes.
Ooh.
And if you're sort of this person who thinks like all of the things that can go wrong, sure enough, you'll hit the golf ball right into the water, or whatever the case may be. Yet, it sounds like if you can create an optimal state of anxiety or pessimism, you'll actually make better decisions, which would actually lead to better outcomes. So how are these motivational speakers just full of it? And it's all sort of, you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you think about optimizing against both of those?
Yeah. So ideas? I think optimism bias is in generally a good thing. Optimism and even a bias, which means an error, right? For a few reasons. One is it gives us motivation to, you know, act and go forward, right? I mean, if I have my own company and I think it's going to fail, well, I'm not going to try. I'm not going to get out of bed. This is what happens in depression. Depression don't have an optimism bias. And so there's no reason to act because there's nothing to gain. So, and if you do think you're going to succeed, that definitely drives your actions, and then you are more likely to succeed. So there's many studies showing that if you have optimistic predictions, you're more likely to have positive outcomes because it changed your action. It's not like magic, think positively and things magically happen. It's I think about things, you know, I believe that they're going to happen, then I change my actions, which make it more likely to happen. Now, still, it doesn't mean it will happen to the sense that I predict. So it's the kind of the old saying, you know, expect gold and get silver. But if you expect no medal, you're probably not going to try and not get any medal. So it is good, and there is a correlation with a lot of positive outcomes. Also with health, if you're anxious and stressed, this is not good for your health. On average, optimists do survive longer and are healthier. So that's true. It's, you know, we know that stress is very, very bad for our health. But then, you know, there's evolutionary examples. You know, to go out of Africa to explore the rest of the world, we have